Welcome back to the Non-Standard 14er podcast, the podcast that talks about everything the route description leaves out about climbing and hiking Colorado's 14ers. Tonight we're talking about trail maintenance and trail building. Joining us tonight is Field Operations Manager for the Colorado Trail Foundation, Darren Raddatz. Welcome to the podcast, Darren.
Yeah, happy to be here. Thanks for the invitation.
And joining our conversation is returning guest, Colorado Trail segment hiker and Coloradan and Michigan fan, Scott. I know him by Wangler.
Hello, Chris. Nugget, whatever I know you by, it depends. Great to be back. Really looking forward to talking to Darren today and learning a lot of the behind the scenes work that is done to make the Colorado Trail accessible and beautiful and well-maintained for all of us. So really looking forward to talking to you, Darren.
So I'll just give you a level setting. I call him Wangler because of his trail name. Mm-hmm. But he's been doing a week on the Colorado Trail for the last three summers. And then I did the whole thing two summers ago. And so I met him near Kenosha, Kenosha Pass to basically Twin Lakes area. And then this summer we did the Collegiate West. And Darren's the field operations manager. I met him the first time last summer doing trail. No, this summer. Up in our Camp mm-hmm. Hale, he was doing a trail crew training, and I was able to adopt a section of the Colorado Trail. So I went to first met Darren, spent a day up near Camp Hale, learning to cut drains and do signage.
Nice.
Can I ask, did you hike the new section by Lake Ann Pass as you were heading southbound, the one that's off the Timberline Trail?
No, it was not open yet, I don't think. Right. Okay. Right, Nugget, because when we came over that, I remember we stopped and we looked and we all it like shoots off to the left. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Yeah. And I think we even paused there and kind of looked at it and said, no, I don't think that was it. And then we proceeded down into all of that mucked up single track stuff, that which is the whole reason why you did the new section. But mm-hmm. Yeah,
that was we follow the Far Out app, right? So is it, you think it will be updated for the new section?
Yep. So that's part of my job. I got the pleasure of hiking it twice. Getting paid to hike, which is just a crazy concept for through hikers. I feel whenever I tell them this story of what I get to do. So yeah, it will be updated. I've been working on that this week actually. So I'll go and look through the data. I'll typically take a couple GPS units with me. And just making sure, try to get the most accurate line, and you can lay them on top of each other. And if you like hopped off the trail to take a pee, you got to make sure to like leave the unit on the trail. And we'll typically hike it in both directions and compare that data. So I've got a couple spots, a couple pee spots. It's what we like to say in the industry where I need to clean up before we head over to the Far Out app, but that'll be happening sometime soon.
So that's really interesting, Darren. So you do that and then provide that to Far Out?
Yep, we do that. Yeah, we're we're often involved in all the realignments, all the trail changes that happen. And so, I feel like it's just a best practice. I probably do it more than maybe some other trail organizations, but as you all know, like data is as good as gold for doing this stuff. So we want to make sure, it's a good product. And with Far Out, they're one of our partners. They actually give us part of the proceeds for every app purchase. And I think it's something like 10% or 15%. It's pretty substantial. And we'll get a quarter check from them from all the purchases for the trail. And, depending, we can, that's kind of a good way for us to track how many people are actually new users getting on the trail. Anecdotally, it's kind of fun to see. But yeah, that's a big part of my job, just making sure we've got that correct data. So we'll provide it to Far Out. We'll provide it for the National Geographic maps that you see. Our guidebook just came out. So yeah, this one didn't make it for our new guidebook. It was still kind of being designed. We had to finalize things last March, and there was still some movement a little bit on the trail. So it'll be in the next one in 5 years, but just a fun part to be involved in this whole process. But you can buy, like, if you just wanted to do a loop, or if you wanted to do like the bike pack, and get that trail alignment. So there's three different aspects that you can buy, and you buy it once. Thing for the whole trail, it's $20, and then it's good for a lifetime, and it automatically updates. And they're really good to work with. So we've had to get in the weeds a little bit, like with Wilderness, I meet with, the trail goes through 11 different ranger districts, through multiple different national forests, and working with them, just trying to figure out like how we can do a better job of managing this trail and interacting with users. So a big thing that popped up is with increased use, particularly after COVID, these wilderness areas have just been like, I don't want to say hammered, but way more use than typical and kind of what was managed for. And so we talked with them and talked with Far Out, and we asked, is there a way where if you enter a wilderness area, a little message would pop up and it would just give you a little bit more rules about, yeah, staying, not camping on the trail, staying 200 feet from water, not, yeah, if you have a campsite, to make sure, following LNT practices to kind of cover it up when you're done. And they were all for kind of implementing this type of program. So that kind of shows you that back and forth and their willingness to kind of help us out with challenges that arise. And that felt like above and beyond. And the Forest Service was really happy with that change.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Before I forget, have we met you before? When we were hiking into Holy Cross Wilderness, and you, I think you were show might have been showing a section of the trail for a potential adopter, and her name was Yard Sale. This would have been a section right
Oh yeah.
before. I think Swangler, you've met Darren in person.
No, I was gonna bring that up. I was definitely gonna bring that up, although I thought it was coming down the backside after Breckenridge, but I don't remember which place it was, but I was almost sure that we had met because I had your card. You gave me your card and we talked about some of the sections of the trail that were open for adopting. And we probably chatted for 15, 20 minutes and
Yeah, that was right on the Holy Cross boundary, I remember, by Wirt's Ditch trailhead going in here. Yep, yeah, and Lauren Jones is the gal, yard sale.
That's
Fun,
funny.
yeah. Small world. It's an absolutely small world in the Colorado Trail. Yep. Through hiker community and trail maintenance, trail work in general. Very small world.
Well, you might not recognize us. We're probably a little more cleaned up tonight than we were that day, but
Yeah.
I think it's a good timing for you to talk to us, Darren, because your trail cruise, or you can sign up for a trail cruise shortly, right? I think it's February 1st. Is that when you announce like your projects that the Colorado Trail Foundation does as far as, 2 or 3 or 4 or 5, 6 day commitments?
Yep. So it's kind of like a mad dash. Everybody asks me like, what do you do in the off season? What do you do in the winter? And when the previous field season ends, which is typically around like October, and if it's a nicer year where I can get out and do some more field visits and site visits with the Forest Service, get approval for projects, I'm doing that even some years up until December. This year I finalized our trail crew schedule, right around Christmas. And so February 1st it'll be live. So I've already, coordinated with a bunch of crew leaders, a bunch of cooks. We have apprentice crew leaders and cooks as well, trying to get more people involved in leadership, kind of fill in some of the retirement of like longtime volunteers. But yeah, it's just about ready to go. And we've got another big season, over 20 trail crew scheduled, anything from a single day, where they're really good for new volunteers. You can just kind of hit the ground running, provide all the your helmet, gloves, everything you need for a project. And then more advanced crews, like a backpack crew that could be 7, 8 days, where you're backpacking in, and we'll even get horse packers to bring in gear to kind of help with the load for those projects, and you're working remotely for that whole time. So we were talking about the Lake Ann alignment. That was one of those backpack crews. So we've been working on that for the past, 4 years, and we'll continue again in 2024 to do some finish work on that project.
But what does the backlog of projects look like? I mean, you said you're gonna have 20 crews, but what does that represent in terms of like what you're managing from a total project backlog?
That's a great question. Yeah, I'm a not the easiest person to go hiking with, having been working in the trail field for 15 years. It's one of those things where, yeah, you're walking on a staircase and you got a wobbly rock and you're like, come on, like, you need to set that thing in there. No, yeah, no, making sure it's good to go. Or yeah, look at this alignment. They could have used more sustainable grades and made it last a bit longer. So more of my process. Yeah, I've got a huge list of projects. So anytime I'm visiting a crew or out in the field, I'm typically like keeping a backlog of those things. We also have a huge trail adapter program that Chris is involved with. So our trail adapters are kind of like our front line. I like to call them kind of our like trail spies. Like they're out there, they're knowing what's involved. If there's a sign that's missing, if there's a big washout, avalanche, they're that first line of contact and oftentimes provide really good information. To kind of add to that project list. And then we're also going to be spearheading, which I'm really excited about, in coordination with the Forest Service, doing a entire Colorado Trail assessment. So we talked to the region last year, and I told them, part of what I want to do is think about managing the trail and figuring out like where are the worst projects, which parts of the trail when you all were hiking that had the worst grade and were just kind of the least sustainable. So in order to do that, there's not technology is kind of caught up to us, and there's some machines that you can use now, like a wheel with a laptop on it that can measure grades, that can measure cross slopes, that can take pictures of bridges, take pictures of structures. So we're in the process of going through kind of what we want to the outputs of what we want through this, and making sure it'll match up with the Forest Service database. And then looking at hiring a couple people to kind of help us collect this data. So it's been done on, I think 50-mile trail is the biggest type of trail. And I know in like Tahoe's done it. There's some places out in Hawaii that have done it. It's kind of slowly spreading out, and I think it's the future of trail management. So being able to have this concrete data that's way more objective than kind of more the subjective stuff that I do of just getting out there and looking at it, we can actually kind of compare these things and figure out which ones are the worst, and then do long-term planning on that way. I see as a huge success and really innovative, and really excites me to kind of do more long-term planning to think about projects 5, 10 years down the line that are harder to do, or a big 35-mile realignment to get the trail off of roads. And being able to do this, we'll go a really long way with getting that approval.
Wangler, I thought he found a reroute of the Colorado Trail when he stumbled onto a deck of a copper condo, having taken the wrong turn in that segment.
Whoops.
Although I would not blame that on the Colorado Trail, I would blame that on my ignorant misinterpretation of the Far Out app. Because as I was winding my way through kind of, that base of copper, 100 yards up the hill kind of area, and I came to this junction, and I'm looking and I'm like, do I go left, do I go right? So what do? I pull out far out, and it says you go right, and I'm like, okay, perfect. So I go right, and I'm going downhill, which doesn't seem to be logically the way to be going. And I
Logical and
literally I
conventional
end up
paths.
like at a condo, and I'm like, darn, that is not right. So I retraced my steps, and I was reading a comment from somebody that was headed northbound, not southbound. And so
The
it was
right is left
reversed,
and left.
right? So I mean, it was completely my fault. But I think the good rule of thumb is never head downhill if you
If you
really.
cannot get to Kokomo Pass downhill, I don't think.
That is for sure. That is for sure. But
Absolutely.
in that little half a mile detour, Nugget passed me by, and I never saw him again until nighttime, I think. So,
Yeah, basically, we slept right near where we're. I met Darren for the trail crew, right near Cascade Falls,
oh yeah,
that night.
it's a nice spot.
Okay, so Darren, you mentioned the trail adopter. Is that the best way to get involved? If anyone's listening and wants to get involved in volunteering?
Yeah, I would say the two main ways, becoming a trail adopter or joining a trail crew. And think about it like this, like the trail, your trail adopter, is more of a long-term commitment. As I described to you, Chris, when you were thinking about getting to this, it's a wonderful way if you've thru hiked the trail, or if you just, love using the trail or have a connection to an area. What better way to, be a trail adopter and help take care of that area, to be that first line, where if, markers go missing, if a tree came down and the marker's gone, you can be that person putting that marker back up. So yeah, somebody doesn't get turned around. You can be the one who, clearing the trees so the hikers, their bellies aren't just covered in cuts, from having to hop over trees, for miles and miles and miles. So yeah, it's a wonderful way to, really give back, in a lot of ways, and on your favorite parts of the trail, being a trail adopter. And if you go to our website, we keep that up to date on what sections are available. And then we ask, if you want to be a trail adopter, at least 2 visits a year to your section. And then there's some required paperwork to do, and some light reporting. But yeah, very easy, light commitment, in my opinion, to get more involved. And then the trail crews, are a way to, I think, just meet other people who love trails. So when I ask people, like longtime volunteers, why do you keep doing this? They're like, man, it's hard to meet other people like this, who really, care about things and want to make a difference. And it's really fun. I think as we get older, it's harder to find opportunities where people are, just have that common goal, where they're working together on hard to do stuff. And it's a very powerful thing, to build a bridge, to build a new trail. And I'll tell you this, if you do a trail crew, you're never going to look at trails the same way. You're never going to look at that large rock. You're going to gain so much appreciation. And just digging in the dirt, it looks like it's easy, but trying to, carve, almost carve like the earth, carve the hillside to with ups and downs. And, there's quite a bit of art to it, that I think most people don't really, it's hard to comprehend unless you've, been down there. And just a wonderful way to kind of learn a new skill, and gain that appreciation. So those are the two main ways to get involved.
It's funny what you just said there about never looking at the trail the same, because I'll tell you my experience with Nugget, which is I met him in 2022 and we hiked, and he was not a trail adopter at that point. And so we hiked and we were blissfully ignorant and just looking at the scenery, and we had a
Yeah,
great
no,
time.
you're good.
And then he became a trail adopter and he went through the training and he has his section that he looks over. And this past year in 2023, we hiked together. And I'm telling you, like every half a mile, he's like, "Hey, Wangler, look right here. This drainage isn't good right here. Like, hey, we could do it, you know, this could be a little built up, or this section is so beautiful. Look how well maintained this is." So it was like this running commentary for 7 days with this guy. So,
Music to my
I mean,
ears. Love to hear it.
it's like you have a beautiful mind when you start seeing like the code everywhere and like you start seeing the perfectly cut 45 degree drains. I was surprised from your training, a day training, how much thought goes into and how many drains are actually on every trail we hike on. We just kind of, before you start looking for them, you just walk over a little bit of a hump, but that's strategically designed 45 kind of to get the any of the runoff off the trail. Otherwise, you get these trails that have all these rocks on it and then they'll just drain into a river. You don't realize how much work and maintenance goes into every probably trail, whether it's a 14er trail, whether it's a local Jeffco County dog park trail, a ton of work.
Yeah, and I've seen a lot, especially in Jeffco, a lot of trails that were created a while ago, have now been eroded. It's just really hard to keep up with the maintenance of those drains, having to do them, annually. And yeah, one given section, if you got like a 10-mile section, you might have a few hundred drains. And then if they're not, being maintained, the rocks show up, and what used to be like a nice walk, or an easier, mountain bike type trail, now becomes very complicated, and kind of goes to a much higher level with who can use those trails. And so I'm definitely seeing a lot of that within the county programs and the city programs, of just trying to get the trails back to their original purpose. And I got to attend a trail seminar. I always like going to the trail seminar to talk to other people in this line of work. And one town, I think this was near Aurora, they ended up bringing in a helicopter to, fill in dirt, on a trail that had been completely washed out. And so they got a bunch of, mineral soil, kind of staged that one area, and then they would just constantly fly the helicopter about 12 hours, a day, and just have the trail crew right there to unload it and tamp it down and just to restore that given trail. Oftentimes you think about trail realignments and that being an easy thing, but depending on the cultural history, the heritage in the area, it's not something that we can get approval to do. So you might be pinned in to trying to make that trail as best as you can. A lot of thought goes into it. And two, some of the realignments we've been worked on were originally proposed in like the early 2000s. The one at Lake Ann, the one over at Hancock. We did some work at Boss Lake. Yeah, those were originally put in 2006, 2007. And they can take oftentimes lots of study, or even if there's a threatened species of an animal, like a lynx that has their habitat in an area, or otherwise it would make for an awesome trail. It might affect their habitat, and so we have to look at other options. So, maintaining. I always try to with these adapter trainings, and just in general, like that is the best thing you can do. It's just getting in there, working those drains every year goes such a long way.
Did you have data on like what the breakdown is of what you're doing all year? Like all the work that goes on the Colorado Trail, is it 70% clearing logs, 20% drains, 30% building bridges?
For adopters, I always like to say like anybody can learn how to clear a tree. Like it's pretty easy. There's some complexities with hazard trees. Like drains are so hard to do, and so hard to get people to understand those concepts. I think with more experience and time, and that's where that adopter program is really neat, because you get to like put in a few drains, come back the next year, see how they worked, kind of tinker with them, figure out better ways to make it more sustainable. But it's sort of, as far as that breakdown of what exactly we're doing, it kind of varies from year to year. Like when I first came on, there was a big avalanche in the Elk Creek area, and so we spent some time clearing those. And I spent a lot of time just kind of figuring out how to get volunteers down there to do it safely, even bringing in a dynamite expert from the Forest
Okay,
Service who
if
helped us
you're in
out.
wilderness area, you can't use chainsaws, but you can blow shit up.
Chainsaws are not allowed. Mechanized use is what we like to say. So no bikes, no wheels. I think it's based on the Mining Act that was something that was put in, that little caveat in there where that is allowed. So there's one guy in Region 2 of the Forest Service, which is kind of Montana down to New Mexico, that we're in here in Colorado. And so he's a like wilderness horse packer dynamite expert. And my understanding, there used to be like way more of these dynamite people, but after 9/11, it became one of those trainings and certifications that kind of just like shrunk with the people they were certifying and just access to explosives and dynamite, rightfully so. So we had to schedule this guy. It took about 3 years before we could find the right schedule. He's coming down from Yellowstone. And then also scheduling it around fire bans, fire season, fire danger. So that was a limiting factor. In 2022, where we couldn't do it.
But those avalanches were 2018. That was that big snow year where you had those monster avalanches in 18, right?
These were like 3 football fields, right in the middle of this Crate Basin, with nowhere to move the trail, kind of left or right, with some of the complexities and how steep that side. So we just kind of picked away at it year after year. And then some of the from the like the height of the avalanche from that 2019, when I 20 is when I first saw it, there's probably like 20 to 30 feet of just debris that we had to clear to get back down to the original tread, so it was safe for people to get through there.
So in the interim, so after that happened, then where did the trail, did it have a redirection or how were people getting?
That was really tough to do. So we got approval from the Forest Service to flag it. So as mechanized use and chainsaws are not allowed, we're also kind of not allowed to put signage up. So it's very
Wilderness
regulated.
area.
We can put like a wooden sign at certain junctions, but otherwise you won't see any trail markers, you won't see confidence markers anywhere in those sections. So how do you show people how to go in an area like this? So we talked to the Forest Service and got permission just to put up some pink flagging, and then roughly tried to cut out a section to make it easier for people to go through. But when I went out there to first see it, Fun little anecdote. Remember seeing a thru hiker who had fell through this debris, probably about 20 feet down in like a little pocket of these sticks, and was wedged with his backpack. So I was lucky enough to, be in the right spot and, had some, rope with me and help bring him
No
out, help
kidding.
bring the backpack out first, and then helped haul him out. And, just sharing those stories of, what's on the ground, what we're kind of dealing with, and why this needs to be a priority, and actually looking into like congressional approval to get chainsaw, access because it's a safety issue. That is the one way they, if it's a big safety issue like this, or if there's a wildfire, you can get approval to get chainsaw use, but we just decided to kind of take the long term and slowly do it, and felt safe with the area that we cut out that people could at least get by in the interim.
Were you around with the dynamite? Did you get to like see the explosions?
I got some video picture of it. I wasn't out that day. We were very secretive. It was one of those things where I think if people heard about, we'd have a big crowd, and that's the last thing you want for doing this work. But the guy is very impressive effort. So he was explaining this whole process to it, and would basically say if there's like a 20-foot pile of avalanche debris, he could only blow up that 20-foot pile and wouldn't affect the trail tread. And was very accurate with how kind of those explosion ranges. So it limited the amount of like backlog work we had to come in and rebuild. Like a hillside to make the trail. So, I was very impressed with that work.
Is
Good.
this the area right by Copper there?
Now this is near Silverton,
Oh,
right?
okay.
Yeah.
So
Yeah. Closer to Silverton. Yeah. Another
I haven't
avalanche.
been
Yep.
there yet,
That was
but
by Copper. We also worked on that one. Fun quick story on that. So when that one came down, it crossed the road, crossed the highway,
Yeah, I
and
went.
even like went up on the other side of the ski hill. Yeah, it was just massive. You could see like 40, 50 feet in the air with the trees that were still standing, like their branches were ripped off, and
Wow.
must have just been like really powerful. So it didn't take out much of the Colorado Trail in that area, but it did leave a big snow patch. So we ended up having to wait, I think it was like 3 years for like the dirty snow debris to melt. Yeah, even through the summers, it would still stay there. And we had to wait for it to melt to rebuild a bridge and a stream crossing that it washed out and just created a little realignment. But I was very impressed with how long and how massive this avalanche and the long lasting effects from it. It's very humbling, having worked in other areas, coming here, learning about avalanches and feeling pretty helpless as far as maintaining a trail when they come around.
Now, is blowing up an avalanche debris anything like blowing up a cow? Isn't
Yeah.
that in your bio? You blew up a cow with
Yep.
dynamite in a slot canyon in Utah?
Yeah, horse. Yeah, my
Horse.
first ever trail crew I did. Right out of high school. I think it was like the first year in college. I went. Yeah, I was at Michigan State. Is where I did my undergrad and natural resource management. And just remember walking through like the campus one day and ran into somebody, and they're like from the Student Conservation Association. They're like, hey, you look like you would like to do outdoor work. Would you ever consider like joining a trail crew out here? And we'll give you an AmeriCorps award. Food and board is provided. Your travel, we'll give you a travel stipend. And I'm just like, this is, like how is this a real thing? And I looked into it, and it was legit. Yeah, it was kind of like that pivot point for me to go into this career. So yeah, I got to go to the Mantyle-Lasalle National Forest and work with a couple other folks on a conservation crew, a trail crew. And yeah, first trail we worked on, we got sent up to go look at some sort of blockage in a slot canyon. And when we got to it, like it was hard to tell what this was. If it was an alien, it had just been like baking in the sun for a few days. And if you've ever seen like a bigger dead animal like that, they just like explode and kind of size, and they just kind of expand. So this thing had it like perfectly expanded in these rocks, and there was no way to get around. It's a very popular horse trail, and I guess it was just somebody's horse, and kind of it was its time. And going up this steep trail, probably had a heart attack and died right there. So we got to go out with the blast person and a few of our trail crew. And I remember the blast person told us like, this is gonna be messy. Like, look at how big this thing is. It's going to go everywhere. Like, make sure to duck. So we were probably about 100 feet away, definitely safe. And one of the guys I was working with was very curious, and he like put his head up, and he ended up having like the fluids and
Oh, of
guts.
an exploded
Never
horse with
forget
some dynamite.
that sound. Yep, just right in the
Oh.
face, and yeah, just that smell is definitely unforgettable as well. But yeah, it's been all downhill ever since.
Okay, so I just want to know so I can get this straight with my buddies that I razz it went to Michigan State. So if you go to Michigan State, you'll have an opportunity to blow up horses. I just want to make sure I get this,
It's an ag
this
school,
right,
yeah.
So,
Yep.
okay.
Yep. First land grant school, yeah. That's
But you have an
funny.
interesting bucket list thing, right? You want to try to do trail maintenance in every state?
Yeah, just one of those fun things. I like to call myself a trails nerd. I love doing this stuff. As you know, I'm pretty frugal. And doing volunteer trail crews, in my opinion, is a great way just to kind of get out and see another place that you probably won't go to. And oftentimes when you're going somewhere to volunteer, people are friendlier, people are more willing to kind of show you around, give you lay of the land. You might be able to get, if you go to national park or something, might be able to get like a special tour. Not the main reason to do it, but just kind of one of those fun things to do. So in November, me and my wife actually just went to the Virgin Islands.
Oh, wow.
So we got married in October, and this was kind of like our unofficial honeymoon. We took time off to go do this trip, prioritize this trip, and I'm lucky to still be married, because just camping and living out in the woods and all that stuff, and getting bit by bugs. But yeah, we absolutely love it. So on that trip, we got to use weed whackers and cut back a bunch of just plants that want to get you. So we don't really have like poison ivy, poison oak in Colorado. But down there, they've got a lot of plants with uricol that'll just give you rashes and just nasty things with hooks and horns and spikes on you. So on the Colorado Trail, we're mostly doing tread work and working on things like that. Very rarely do we have to do a bunch of big corridor work. On this trip, yeah, just a weed whacker going over your head in kind of a big radius, clearing everything
Oh,
out.
wow.
So it's very humbling, and definitely gained a great appreciation for what I do here, and just kind of fun to shake it up. I got a good grasp of what I do, but always open to learn something new, and always fun to go to a new spot, and
Yeah.
just keep
Was
learning.
that on St. John?
Yep, that was over on St. John, stayed out of the Cinnamon Bay
Nice.
campground, worked with the Friends of the Virgin Island National Park, is the hosting group there.
Nice. Nice.
And before the Colorado Trail, you were doing, where were you at doing trail work?
Yeah, before this, bounced around. I've worked for the Pacific Crest Trail, worked for them for a year. Let's see, I've worked at a bunch along the Appalachian Trail. Right before this, I worked for a small little park in southern Maine called Mount Agamenicus as the park manager over there. So one of the fun things I got to do out there was build a accessible trail, about a mile accessible trail, and got to learn that whole process of figuring out grades. The grades are between like 3 and 5%, very meticulous, using a little laser level to make sure things are good, and building platforms off of an old like ski lift, and using those kind of cement pads, the base, to build platforms, viewing platforms for people. And just had a wonderful time out there, and was really drawn to this position with the Colorado Trail, just the immensity of it, almost 600 miles of trail. And just being able to kind of have a bigger scope of work. It's the main allure.
I'm curious, Darren, and this isn't going back to a Michigan State thing at all, but just in general, for your role as field operations manager, like what does the typical training or educational path look like? Are there universities that have particular programs that specialize in that kind of thing, or just what does that look like?
Yeah, I think we're right at the foreground of this becoming more of like a legitimate job in a lot of people's eyes, and even like people realizing it as a career. Yeah, when I started doing this, that Utah trip with the horse, I remember telling people, and I wanted to do this. And yeah, I grew up in Michigan, grew up outside of Detroit in Port Huron area, about an hour north of there. And people are like, "What, you want to work on trails? Like, that's just, wait, why would you want to do this? That's ridiculous." You know, it's very labor intensive. And I think we've gotten to the point, especially with working with the Forest Service. It used to be kind of like the Forest Service would hire a bunch of trail crew, and they would have these very expansive staffs, and they would be the ones managing all the trails involved. And that's how it was kind of since the beginning. And more recently, I would say in like the last 5 to 10 years, it's been shifting more towards volunteer organizations like Colorado Trail Foundation, Student Conservation Association. Yeah, all the long distance trails have their own kind of association that helps manage it, and just kind of a way to be that middle, kind of that middle person where things can go a little bit smoother, where you're not as big as a organization. So yeah, as far as trainings, we're starting to see some universities that are accrediting as far as like becoming a trail worker, where you could get more of a trade type of position where you could get the experience doing it. But I think for if you want it, if somebody's listened to this and really wanted to kind of have a role, the best way to do it is just to get out there, join a trail crew, kind of work your way up from the bottom. And that's more of my path, just getting out there, making good relationships with the people that you work with, and using them as references. And like I've gotten positions in other states where I just knew the person I worked with them briefly, and they're like, "Yeah, this guy's solid. Let's bring him on. He's good." So that is, by far, I feel like the best thing you can do. And if you wanted to work with the Forest Service, there's a huge hiring initiative going on right now to try to fill some positions where they've had trouble filling in the past. Working in these beautiful locations, Breckenridge. Are working here in Salida, where they oftentimes have more positions open, than applicants to hire individuals. So that has been a huge change. When I've worked for the Forest Service for a few seasons, and it was very, very competitive, and kind of had to try everything you can to get those jobs. And even like the seasonal jobs were really hard to get. And now I think the culture's changed a little bit for what people are looking for as far as jobs, and maybe not as alluring. And I think just the cost of living at some of these locations is another big factor. But I feel like it is a better time than ever if you want to get into the trails field. And there's also a Professional Trail Building Association conference. So this past year, I got to go to it. It was in Reno, Nevada. I think we had over 1,000 people attend
Really?
all over the place. There was a yeah some folks I got to talk to from Iceland. It was really fascinating, kind of hearing how they build trails in the tundra. A bunch of people in Australia, New Zealand, a lot of Europeans, and then people from all over the states. And so they, one of the days, you could actually get a accredited certification for like using heavy machinery for building trails. So they rented out a park, and you could get out on a bobcat or a little excavator and or a skid steer and learn, some of these tricks of the trade. And on that website as well, you can see who all the private trail contractors are. And that's been kind of fun to follow. That's absolutely exploded. And I've got some friends in this field, and they're backlogged many years in advance, working for, as I was mentioning, just these towns and a lot of the government agencies really aren't doing this work anymore, and it's more contract based, and hiring private individuals, private companies to do this work. So yeah, I think it's a fantastic career if you love being outdoors, love working with people. And I feel like it's very meaningful work, being a part of something where so many people get kind of have that chance to reset, that brings happiness to them, and can just kind of disconnect from some of those stresses that we have in normal day-to-day life.
You have like so on those trail crews, you could be a cook too, right? So if you're someone who can't move a 50-pound boulder and doesn't want to hike, there's spots for like other people, right? They don't have to be just a Hulk.
Yeah, we don't need all hawks. We try to work smarter than harder. We can use certain tools. We even had access to a power wheelbarrow for a project this summer. It's a gas powered wheelbarrow where you just load things up into it, and it's got the two handles on there for your brake and your throttle. So we're trying to make volunteering kind of and figuring out roles for just everybody who wants to do it. So for a typical base camp crew, we'll have about 25 people come out for that. Usually one or two cooks for it. And the food is absolutely important. You're working hard. We'll provide breakfast, lunch, and dinner.
So is
And
that like so is that like a ramen bomb to serve 25?
very, very good meals. We'll mix it up. We've got some wonderful cooks. A few cooks that I know, like people will sign up just because they know that they're cooking on a particular crew and the meals are
Oh, really?
fantastic. And they'll cook a brisket. We even have like an ice cream maker. I don't know if you all have seen the soccer ball style where you put
Oh,
you
yeah,
get
where
some
you.
milk in there, you get some ice or ice in there and usually some rock salt, and then you just kick it around for a while.
Really?
We've got a wooden one, a little wooden bucket with a crank on it is another style. We'll just pass it around for a few hours after work, and then at the end you got some sweet ice cream. So typically desserts are included in these meals. We feed people really well. And jobs for everybody. And wide variety. We're even open to youth being involved. We had a crew this past summer with a grandfather, dad, and a grandson all involved in one particular crew. And then there was another family that with that same situation, and just seeing like multiple generations of volunteers and people traveling from a long ways away and wanting to spend their time, that quality time together, is really, really meaningful. But yeah, very much open to wide ranges. And if you see our trail crew schedule, it'll say like which crews are more strenuous. There's one crew near the high point, where I even say in there like this is by far the most difficult crew on the schedule. Just trying to help people out, self-select, with their limitations and what they're doing. And usually the base camp crews, you're not hiking too far. You might have to hike up to a mile to a project. So all that's really well laid out in those descriptions.
Now, is the true kind of a vestige of what Goody Gaskell, kind of the godmother of Colorado Trail, kind of did in the early 80s to really connect the trail from Waterton to Durango? If you feed them, basically they'll come, kind of.
Oh yeah. Yep, yeah, she set the standard. Absolutely. And I love hearing stories about her. There's still so many people who've worked with her over the years and still around now. One of her legacies, they would do like 50 crews a summer. Like I was saying, we do about 20, 25 a year, and that feels like it's my britches are stretched them all the way out and the button's gonna break. And hearing their stories of doing 50, and mostly new trail in those days, which is very difficult work. I gain a huge appreciation for everything that they did. And the Gaskills are still very much involved. We've worked with a few of her sons and a few of her daughters over the years. And 2024 is actually the 50th anniversary of the Colorado Trail. So
Oh,
I'm
really?
very excited. We've been doing a lot of reflecting during this time, I would say about the start of it.
How
Are
do
you gonna
you do anything for that publicity-wise, or just
Yeah,
what?
we're planning a big camp out at Twin Lakes. It's still coming together. I think it's going to be in July. That'll be a weekend. We're looking to have potentially like some live music, and just get together like all of our events, volunteers, donors, through hikers, anybody who's been involved in the trail, just to get together, tell some stories, reflect, kind of bond over this wonderful thing that's brought us all together.
Well, that's the 50th anniversary of like the idea, right? So it'd be 1973. Wait, no.
Yeah,
How do you pick
74.
when they, because versus like the Golden Spike ceremony when the actual trail was completed, that was later.
Yeah, so there it yeah, there is a little controversy. There's even some signs that say 1973. So we just decided 74, and it gave us a little bit more planning time as well to do this
There
instead
you
of
go.
last year. Peel back the curtain. Yep.
And so, how many are actually full-time employees at the Colorado Trail Foundation?
So we've got an executive director. We've got myself. We have an outreach manager, and then we have an office manager as well. So those are the
Four.
full-time employees. We also have a very robust store. So you might have seen that this hat is some new merchandise that we've come up with, and a bunch of really cool stuff. If you really like the Monarch Crest area, we've got this fun sun hoodie based on a sign that's there, vertical sign, and then kind of cartooned the sunset and the silhouettes of the mountains. So we've got one person that's helping to run the store. And then I also have a part-time. I'll be actually looking to hire this position. So May through October, helping with just field support, trail crews, kind of prepping things, doing site visits. Getting paid to hiking, as we were talking about. So it's a 25 hours a week. Just May to October seasonal position. That's another part of it. And then we have a very robust board of people who kind of help us from anything to from managing our budgets. We've got like party planning is another big part of our board of directors, helping with the guidebook, any literature. So it's everybody kind of has a certain task. And I think we've got 13 board members right now. We meet with them quarterly as well.
You know,
It's incredible.
a question I had, and Nugget mentioned it earlier when we were, you know, he mentioned how much snow there was this year on Collegiate West, and you know, our estimate was we bet we crossed 100 snow fields, and you know, 20 of which were like steep enough that if you did something stupid, you were going to slide a ways, right? And you know, potentially into a boulder field. So is there any seasonal mitigation or anything that you do with snow, or is that just purely a when it melts and you know, you're at your own risk kind of thing? What is there?
Yeah, more of the latter. We've looked at potentially getting some snow readers up there. There's some other volunteer groups that are doing this right now where you could get better accurate information to trail users. It's a very common thing. Come like May and June, people are asking, when's the trail gonna be open? When's the
Oh,
trail
yeah.
gonna be open? And it's
Sure.
such a tough question to ask, or asking if it's safe. And those are not yes or no answers. So yeah, we try our best to share that information. Like our Facebook page, the socials are kind of a great way where you can crowdsource that information and get the best out of it. The Far Out app is also kind of really good in those situations. I remember, I think it was 2 years ago, we had a big, maybe 3 years ago, there was a really big snowstorm in September up on Monarch. And we, the, yeah, and during this time, we still had, quite a few, I'd call it like the herd, still quite a few people out there. And without, you're above tree line, good luck trying to find the trail when 2 feet of snow, 3 feet of snow kind of come out of nowhere. So being able to, follow your track and know where you are with the Far Out app and being able to use it without service really, save these people from getting lost and turned around and could have been a much worse situation. But yeah, snow's a really tough thing to manage, and I've got lots of experience trying to figure out realignments, getting out there early in the season, working with crew leaders who want to go check out their projects as soon as they can, being really enthusiastic and excited, and we get out there 5 miles in, it's still covered in snow, and we're like, yeah, oh man, bummer, gotta go hike this again.
Yeah, we had a couple of spots where, you know, in middle of July where we had trouble following the trail and we ended up doing some bushwhacking and, you know, just, I mean, it was tough.
And that snow hurts too. If you don't have like good pants on, I've hiked it, kind of done like the high socks and shorts thing, and got the knees exposed. And yeah, that snow that's been sitting out there is very granule, which is it's almost like like dipping into glass, broken glass or something, to just get you all cut up. So yeah, more what I worry about are those CDT hikers in the early season. I know last year most of them just kind of slingshotted past some of those big snow areas. So with the CT being a shorter trail, more people, we just recommend, just waiting a little bit until you know the snow is clear, or the Collegiate West typically is higher and kind of holds snow a bit more than the Collegiate East. So yeah, having that additional option can be nice if people are limited on their time frame for when they can through hike.
On the trail cruise last year, there was a big project on Fooses, wasn't there? Fooses Creek, and that very,
Yep.
very steep section of the Collegiate East when it right before it reconnects with the West, and that basically right where that trail sign you were talking about on the sweatshirt.
Yep.
Did they make that a lot less steep? Because it was, I think it was the steepest section of the trail.
Yeah, that was up there. Yeah, almost 50% grade.
Ooh.
And most thru hikers, or if you're bikepacking, you're going southbound, and having to go straight up that. So yeah, that was one of those projects that initially was proposed in 2006, and that was the one I was mentioning with lynx habitat was a complicating factor as
Oh.
to why we couldn't get approval for it. So yeah, when I came on in 2020, we were kind of hearing down the grapevine that there would be really good potential to make it happen. And so I was involved in the layout process. So it's when you're laying out a trail, you're kind of open to all possibilities whatsoever. So it's getting out there, it's hiking both sides of that big bowl in the Fooses Creek area. It's looking at, we like to call them like control points or just features. So if there's a big glacial erratic that might be fun to take the trail by that you think people would find value in, you try to design it that way. It's a ton of just looking at topo maps, aerial maps, and then getting out there in the field and ground truthing it to kind of figure out the final alignment. And then also keeping in mind, yeah, sustainable grades, not wanting to go over 10%, adding a bunch of switchbacks, figuring out, yeah, camping, water sources. So it's a lot involved. I probably hiked
Yeah.
that. I've probably been out there maybe 100 times since I started, just mostly helping out with this project and getting the final layout. So at the end of 2023, we're happy to report that new trail is open. The old alignment is open as well at this point. And then in 2024, right now, this field season, we're going to close that old alignment section. Typically that's a Forest Service decision. It's not our decision, but typically if there's, yeah, two access points and a particular trail, if you build a new trail that isn't primarily used by a big user group like the one at Lake Ann with the Timberline trail, that's a motorized trail, that warrants keeping it open. But with, yeah, typical realignments, we'll just close the old sections. So that's going to be a lot of the work that we do this season, is just working on closing that. And then a couple touch up spots on the new alignment. Some of the switchbacks are a little tight. That area gets a ton of mountain bike use. So,
Right.
when we
Fooses,
build a
yeah.
trail, we won't just build it for hikers. We want to think about all our trail users. And I'll walk it. I even took my bike out there, and then I even had a guy on a horseback get out there and ride it on his horse just to, hear his perspective. How does this feel? How tight is this? How's this drop off feel? Do we need to put in some areas, and with a lot of accessible trails and other kind of new trail design, you'll have resting intervals where it's just an area where people can pull off, to pass and just
Oh.
make it easier. So we're thinking about things like that. And yeah, as we were talking about drains earlier, a new trail doesn't have those big old bumps that we were building. With a new trail, you can design it and just kind of have ups and downs. We call those grade reversals, where the water can just naturally shed. So we're, yeah,
Oh.
building all those into it and making it more like self-sustaining, where it's not going to need as much maintenance as an old undesigned trail would need. So I'm really happy with how this turned out. I feel like this is, yeah, one of the best projects I've ever been involved with. And we got quite a bit of pushback from some user groups that really loved that old alignment. That was very technical, a lot of speed, but it might, yeah. So this area would maybe work for one small little niche user group, but for everybody, for the greater good, for the majority of our users, it wasn't ideal. So that's why this new alignment came about. It was just really fun to work on, and yeah, we even have a got some helicopter firefighters involved this fall on that project as well, if you'd like to know about that.
Sure.
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah, so. Yeah, our executive director, Tisha. So she did, I think it was the Backpacker Radio podcast this summer, and the chief of the state fire department, Wildland Fire Department, heard it and was like, "This is awesome! I didn't know, groups like this exist and need support." So he reached out to us and said, like, "Hey, we've got access to some firefighters with chainsaw skills and potentially a helicopter. Are there any projects that you would like some help with?" And I thought, we kind of thought it was like a joke at first, and maybe some spam, and then quickly realized that it was legit. So we thought about this project, and so most of the tread work had been good to go. But the main issue that we had were when we went through here, we'll clear the corridor for it, and we had a bunch of stumps just in the way. And then we had a bunch of hazard trees as well, a bunch of dead trees. So there's beetle kill spruce trees in the area that were just like standing dead and becoming hazards. So I told them about all this, and yeah, access is limited. It's about like 6 miles to hike in from each side and very limiting. And yeah, chainsaw hazard tree work is not something that we typically do, and it's kind of outside of our scope. So I'm like, this would be fantastic to have you all come out there. So yeah, within a couple weeks, we got it on the schedule, got it in the books, and yeah, I got to work with them and show them the location. And then I think it was like a day or two before it happened in early October, we got a big snowstorm. So the trail was just like great snow free, and then that we got like 2, 3 feet of snow. And I was talking to the guys. I'm like, you still want to get out there? They were thinking about camping there, just being dropped off right at that new trail, camping out there for a couple of days and coming back out. And they're like, I don't know about camping, but we're still on board to cut the trees. So yeah, coordinated with them, use Monarch Mountain during that time. Yeah, not really too much activity. So use that as one of the bases for the helicopter to transport gear, and then brought them right up to, yeah, where that sign is, where Selfoose's and Monarch come in, dropped them off there with all their gear. Yeah, about 10 guys went out there, and I think they cleared something like 100 trees and like 50 stumps within a 2 day time period. And the strangest thing, this happens a lot in this field where like people have a meaningful experience volunteering, and they'll just profusely thank us for doing this work. And I just think it's the silliest thing. Like, y'all spent, I don't know how much money for that helicopter, for hotels, for gas, for people's pay, and you're like thanking us for the opportunity to get some hazard tree training. But we're kind of, yeah, being in this volunteer realm, I think it's this like sweet spot where, because it is volunteer, I think more people are willing to kind of like go above and beyond with wanting to help and make a difference. And one of the firefighters was kind of funny. He hadn't really done trail work before. And he was having a little bit difficulty of figuring out what trees he should take out or not. And I'm like, you got kids? And he's like, yeah. I'm like, well, if you're out here with your kid, your daughter, would you feel safe with these trees? And he's like, nope, I absolutely wouldn't. So, it kind of felt good, like protecting the community and giving back. So yeah, just a really fun success story. It's one of those things I had no idea how we were going to get done, and then it just dropped out of the sky. So we'll never know what comes out of this experience. High expectations, but never know.
It's rewarding work. I mean, you never have someone when you're cutting trees, someone walk by and say, "Get out of my way." Every single hiker that you see is like, "That's awesome. You're volunteering. Thank you so much for cutting these trees down." And it's really fun work, rewarding. And it's really fun to see like three or four trees, dead trees, beetle kill trees on your section, and you take like an hour to chop all the limbs off, and then you have a
Oh,
before picture
yeah.
and after picture. It's just very, very like satisfying.
Well, good to hear. Yep. What's your tool of choice? Would you get for clearing trees?
I just bred one of your bow saws, because I don't know
Oh
if you know
yeah.
that they in Poncha Springs there, that's their center, their office. So when I go to my section, I swing through Poncha Springs and check out a helmet and a bow saw and a McLeod and a Pulaski, which is a lot to carry for one person. So I think I might just do bow saw and Pulaski next time.
What a bow.
But I also need to
Nice.
figure out how to get a crosscut saw, because I have a couple big trees across my section that I'll need probably two people on a crosscut saw.
Yeah, there's training opportunities. I'm actually looking into becoming a crosscut trainer to provide more trainings for our volunteers to do that. And then there's, yeah, trainings put on by other volunteer groups in the Forest Service. So if that's something you're interested in, we could definitely get you a training and get you certified. And I've got about 15 crosscut saws. So if you're certified, they're all, yeah, 100-year-old plus,
Yeah, they're cool looking.
just vintage, ready to go. I got a volunteer in the area who has a big passion for buying them off eBay or getting them off a wall, polishing them up, sharpening them up. That's very difficult to do. It's very small thresholds, like a thousandth of an inch, to line them up so they make sure they cut really well. So he's donated a bunch of saws and just wants to see them in volunteers' hands. So yeah, if we get more people certified, we could definitely get you one of those to do more good work.
That'd be fun. We gotta
Oh
get the
yeah.
trail cleared for Wangler to walk through there next summer.
I
Yep.
know. I know.
Yep.
I got another 100 miles to do next summer, so.
Nice.
I think since this is a 14er podcast, I'll just circle back and just mention how much I bet a lot of people who climb the 14ers don't realize how much of the trail they were actually maybe on the Colorado Trail, whether it was maybe through doing Elbert or right by Mount Massive. And if you do San Luis from the Creede side, you're on the Colorado Trail for a bit. Maybe
Yeah.
if you did Huron from like the Lake Ann side, you were on the Colorado Trail, I bet, for a bit. Where else can remember? I'll do an Antero from like Little Browns. That
Yeah.
area near Buena Vista, I think I was on the Colorado Trail for a couple miles. You have to be actually physically trained for a crosscut saw? Is that part of like liability issues?
Yep. Yeah. So that's a Forest Service standard. So it's just one of those best practices where they feel like the associated risk is too much just to let people go out. So now we can just technically send people out with a pigmatic to go and dig things in the trail, and you don't need any certifications to use a trail tool like that. But for a crosscut, where you're typically much more remote, and that's a big safety part of it as well. And so there's differing ways that you can be certified. So you can be certified in bucking, which is just clearing the trees that have fallen down on the trail that are blocking access. And you can get certified in felling, of taking those trees down, which we might do for a bridge project. Need to come in a
Oh, yeah.
wilderness area to do some felling that way. So it's just a way to kind of help with the risks involved. So same thing with chainsaw. There's specific classes for each of those. And back east, I worked in the White Mountain National Forest for a little bit. There's even a axe training. We can get certified in different using different axes, and that's kind of mainly what they do in the Northeast for clearing down trees. Everybody's got an axe, like the Appalachian Mountain Club. Their trail crew will even do like this saucy picture at the end of the trail season, where they're all like their shirts are off and they got their axes and looking all sweaty and
That's what we need for our Lake Ann picture. We jumped in the Lake Ann shirtless last summer, a big crosscut saw. How long does the bucking training take? Is it a day? You do the bucking
typically
training?
just a day,
Oh, cool.
for
Sweet.
the basic intro, for it. And they're changing a lot of the curriculum. It used to be much more harder to get these certifications, and you had to there's A, B, and C levels, and then there's kind of limitations on how much you can cut. They might limit you to 10 foot or a 10 inch tree, I mean, or a 20 inch tree that you're able to cut. So some of the courses now you can do online and save just some of the time consuming aspect and just go in for one day of a field work. And the main requirements for that, they ask for a up-to-date CPR first aid.
Oh.
That's about it. You don't need any saw experience to get involved in these.
Where can you go, Darren? Is there a good summary resource place to get information on those certifications and in training?
Yeah, it's really tough. I have a hard time getting this. So what I'll typically do is try to reach out to the groups, and when I know about them, I'll email them out to our volunteers of people. Like Chris has told me he's interested. I can work with him and let him know, like, hey, this is coming up. This is more in your neck of the woods. Check this out. We'll even offer to pay so if there's a class cost for trainings like
Oh,
this, or
cool.
the class cost for CPR. Well, I think we've got that information on our website, but I think we're willing to cover like part of that cost to make that happen.
How many how often are you in the office in Poncha Springs, or how often are you actually out on trail?
Yeah, this time of year, in the office, pretty much most days, unless there's something I want to go double check and try to get on the trail. But in the summer, I try to be out in the field as much as I can. I'm out in the field typically at least 5 days a week in the summer. Then those off days, I might check some email and do some other coordination, that sort of thing. But there'd be days, I might have to go visit a crew that's by Waterton Canyon in Denver, and then the next day we got a crew starting up in Durango, working on Junction Creek area and having to get out there. So I put in a ton of drive time in the summer, and yeah, hauling a lot of trailers. So I'm sort of like the guy behind the scenes, just making sure things go smoothly. I think of myself as more of like a coach, just trying to make sure people are set up for success and they kind of know what they're doing. And yeah, work with a lot of wonderful people, who are very passionate about doing this work, making me look good.
Well, now you got a new podcast to listen to when you're doing all that windshield time.
I caught a couple this week in prepping for it. I listened to your Colorado Trail one, and then a little bit of the Camp Hale one.
Okay.
If you haven't picked this up, Love Talking Trails. Always fun. I don't have a lot of family members, and I do have some friends who like talking about this, but normally I can't get anybody to talk for more than 10 minutes, so it's been a pleasure.